Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Ray, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio! The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, the call-in listeners, or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Free people will never remain free if they are not willing, if need be, to fight for their vital interests.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Praise God. Ammunition.
The Restoration Hour with Pastor Eli James.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Pastor Eli James here, back in the saddle at www.freedomslips.com. Revolution Radio, this is the Restoration Hour, simulcasting on yourfolkradio.com. And it looks like I've got a very low signal, so let me see if I can adjust that here. The signal I'm displaying here on my broadcaster is very, very low, so let's see if I can adjust this. Hold on, folks. Yeah, I don't want to overpower the freedomslips.com signal, something unusual here, but I just, okay. Yes, thank you, Nighthawk. He says, I'm just fine on that side, so we may have to rely for archive purposes on the archive from freedomslips.com. So very unusual, because we just did a show last night on Eurofolk Radio, no issues at all with the the broadcaster we use. So I'll just continue. Hopefully people on those who are listening on Eurofolk Radio are hearing us okay. If not, just go ahead and switch over to freedomslips.com and listen there. Thank you. Thank you, Nighthawk. All right, so to the subject of today's show is going to be the Jews and the Civil War, actually the Jews in Mexico and the Civil War, because this is a completely blacked out subject, as is typical of Jewish involvement in the issue of slavery, Jewish impersonation of Christians, the so-called Marrano Jews of Christian Spain. Well, they went to Mexico, folks. They went to Mexico. They also came to America. And many of these Marrano Jews were either Spanish Jews or Portuguese Jews, who did the same thing. They pretended to be Christians, or they just kind of faded into the background practicing Judaism without trying to make much of their presence known or felt. They prefer to operate in secret, and therefore they want to keep their secret operations secret. So it's very rare for an article to appear in the Forward, which is a Jewish publication, about the Jewish involvement in the slave trade in the Americas. And this article is entitled, Jews Mostly Supported Slavery or Kept Silent During the Civil War, by Ken Yellis. And this was published in July 2013. And it goes like this. Whenever I told someone that I was working on an exhibition called, quote, Passages Through the Fire, Jews and the Civil War, I typically got two responses. Both reflect the need for the exhibit now on display at Yeshiva University Museum in New York. I'm wondering if this author, Mr. Yellis, is Jewish or not, but probably Jewish, which presents the widely forgotten story of the full participation of Jews in the nation's great existential crisis. Okay. Well, most of you listening to this show, The Restoration Hour, are aware of the Jewish involvement in the American Civil War, but you're not going to get this kind of information anywhere else because the Jews typically want to keep this topic quiet. They don't want you to know about the heavy Jewish involvement in the American Civil War, such as the Rothschild banking family and the John Wilkes Booth being a Jew and the Knights of the Golden Circle and the Freemasons and, of course, B'nai B'rith. You cannot ignore the involvement of B'nai B'rith in the American Civil War. And they were actually the ones directing the activities of John Wilkes Booth and the spying operation. Judah P. Benjamin, of course, being the Jew behind the South, the secession. So the involvement of the Jews in the Civil War is absolutely major, and you have to study this subject with a critical eye because the Jewish press, the kosher press, the kept press, does not broach this subject very often. And, of course, this the Forward is a Jewish publication. It's one of those in-house publications that only Jews read. So, and if a so-called Gentile or a non-Jew actually broaches the subject, it'd be very hard to find information on this. You have to really do a search with carefully titled searches so that you can find out what's really going on. You usually have to include the subject of secret societies, B'nai B'rith, the Rothschilds. If you don't include the names in your search, the Rothschilds in the Civil War, for example, that you won't find out much because much of this information is kept hidden from the public. So here this guy is doing an art exhibit, and so he wrote this article as a promo for his art exhibit. Let me check something here real quick. Testing. Yeah, where my voice meter program is working just fine. And it's not an issue with voice meter. There's something going on in my broadcaster. In any case, let's continue. He says, my sister's reaction was typical. There were Jews in the Civil War? Who knew? Right? This is not a subject that is broached publicly. The second most common response was in some ways more interesting. The Jews who fought in the Civil War were against slavery, right? What have I been telling you, folks? The answer, he says, the discomforting answer is not so much. No, the Jews were pro-slavery. Even the Jews in the North had house slaves, had house servants. It wasn't just in the South. So New York City Jews and Boston Jews had house slaves. They were not opposed to slavery. They were the ones that brought the slaves to America and sold them out the auction block. Let's continue. As Jewish historian, now, of course, this is a subject that the Jews must keep quiet because they have to pretend to have a squeaky clean history where they are the oppressed and everyone else is oppressing Jews. Of course, it's the exact opposite because they always infiltrate countries with their money lords, and then their rabbis creep in with their Talmudic teachings, and then the rest of the parasitic crew of vampires invades the nation. That's how the Jews operate. That's why the Jews have been expelled from over 100 countries in Christian history. Let's continue. As a Jewish historian, Dale Rosengarten expresses it, quoting a Talmudic precept, quote, the law of the land is the law of the Jews, unquote. Now, of course, this is itself a deception, because the Jews have kept their Talmudic laws intact wherever they go. It's rare for a Jew to actually practice the laws. And, you know, it's the same as when in Rome do as the Romans. But the Jews don't do that. They simply pretend to do as the locals, as the indigenous. From a modern perspective, it seems anomalous that a people whose history hinged on an epic scale from servitude, of course he's referring to the Israelites of the Bible, which the Jews are not, wouldn't, in fact, they are descendants of Esau, who were never in slavery, who were never in servitude. John chapter 8 tells us that. So that a people who would seemingly be opposed to oppressive servitude would support it in the New World. Well, no, the Jews have been the world's slave masters for eons. So anyway, the people who supposedly have a history hinged on an epic escape from the servitude would not have been deeply troubled by America's peculiar institution, but they few of them were troubled by slavery. The Jews ran the slave trade, and most Jews actually owned slaves as house servants, because there's no such thing as a Jewish farmer, although they may have invested in plantations. Jews don't do farm work. They hire other people. They usually hire white people to do the farm work and anybody else they can hire. Let's continue. Some Jews owned slaves. A few traded them. I would start that sentence with the word many. Many Jews owned slaves. Many traded them. And the livelihoods of many, North and South, were inextricably bound to the slave system. Thank you very much. Most Southern Jews defended slavery, and some went further, advocating its expansion. Now, remember, I've been telling you my entire series on the history of secession and the conflict between the North and the South was due to the expansion of slavery. That was the issue. Expanding slavery from the states in which it already existed to potential new states, and or the potential invasion of other countries so that the slavers could get more slave territory. It was expansion. So thank you very much for bringing up this subject. Again, you get snippets of truth in these articles written by Jews, but never the whole truth and never a really clear explanation of what's going on. I will try to do that as I read through this article, which is pretty short. But then I'm going to get into the Jews of Mexico leading up to the Civil War. All right, so notable among these Jews was Judah P. Benjamin, labeled by the abolitionist Ben Wade, who served with Benjamin in the United States Senate as, quote, an Israelite with Egyptian principles, unquote. That's good. I had never heard that quote before. So, but of course, he is not an Israelite. He's an Edomite. An Edomite with Egyptian principles. Even in the North, many sympathized with the South. He means many Jews sympathized with the South, and only a very few were abolitionists. Almost all Jews sought peace above all else. Until the war was at hand, they remained silent on the subject. Of course, the Jews don't want to expose. That's why they remain in the background, pulling strings, making deals, all right? Because all of this is economic, whether or not to support slavery or not. So Jews kept quiet on this debate as much as possible so they could hedge their bets. He says, for me, that silence is problematic. As Arnie in Nathan Englander's short story, Camp Sundown, puts it, quote, the turning away of the head is the same as turning the knife, unquote. Well, you know what's going on, but you don't say anything about it. Why? Well, because, well, maybe you're involved. Maybe your brother-in-law is involved. Maybe your aunts, uncles, parents are involved in the slave trade. So why would you say much about it? You wouldn't. Yet the majority of American Jews were mute on the subject, perhaps because they dreaded its tremendous corrosive power. Well, yeah, that's why they kept silent. They didn't want to take sides in the dispute because why? Well, that would be dangerous. Even though the Jews were the most responsible for the creation of the conflict. Prior to 1861, there are virtually no instances of rabbinical sermons on slavery, probably due to fear that the controversy would trigger a sectional conflict in which Jewish families would be arrayed on opposite sides. And yes, Jewish families would then have to face the opposition of the non-Jewish public, depending on which position they took. So they remained silent, which is a tactical move. It's a tactical move. Nobody said the Jews are stupid. And this is exactly what happened. They simply stayed silent. Ironically, the silence was breached by an attempt to forestall the conflict. With Lincoln's election and the gathering momentum of the secession movement, the celebrated New York rabbi Morris Raphael attempted to make a case for reconciliation by defending slavery on biblical grounds. Well, of course, this is exactly what Southern Christian ministers did. And of course, the idea that blacks descended from Ham is a Jewish idea. That's where the Southern preachers got that notion from. Of course, that's a lie. Ham, Shem, and Japheth were all white Adamites. They didn't change the color of their skin or the features of their skeletal frame by moving from place to place. That doesn't happen, folks. So this is a Jewish idea. And I'm sure the Jewish community was upset that Mr. Rabbi Morris Raphael actually took a public stance on this issue, because this would force Jews to confront the issue, which is something they didn't want to do. He says, well, let me repeat this. The celebrated New York rabbi Morris Raphael, of course, celebrated only in Jewish circles because no one else ever heard of Rabbi Morris Raphael, attempted to make a case for reconciliation by defending slavery on biblical grounds. The speech had the opposite effect, triggering furious rebuttals from Rabbi David Einhorn and biblical scholar Michael Heilprin, among others, and widening the growing divide. Jews had at last engaged in numbers with the great issue of the age. Now, of course, you have to understand that not all Jews are Talmudic Jews. Most Jews don't even understand that the Talmud is the driving force of Judaism and the driving force of the rabbinical Judaism. The Jews themselves are taught that they're descendants of the Israelites and that their religion is the Mosaic Law. Well, that's not true. That's just another rabbinical lie. But there are many Jews who understand that this is the case, that Judaism is a fraudulent religion, has nothing to do with the Bible. The Jews are not Israel. Many Jews know this. But they play along, because what else can they do? Either they play along with the rabbinical and banking mafia and lose whatever possessions they might have by being involved in that mafia. They can then make their own way in life and just forget about their Jewish heritage and just try to blend in. That's what a lot of Jews do. I've met such Jews, and it is a difficult life because you have to reject your heritage, reject your family, reject your contacts, and then you have a difficult time. Actually, some of these Jews feel very guilty about being Jewish because they know what Judaism really is. And it's very hard for such people to look you in the eye because they feel guilt, which is probably due to the fact that they have some white blood in them. Okay. So, because typical Jews don't have any guilt. They have no conscience. They treat us as cannon fodder. That's all we are, is cannon fodder. All right. So, quote, passages through fire is filled with such stories. What emerges from them is the heartfelt, touching personal language in which they are told, often by people whose English is newly learned. In other words, Jews who haven't made up their minds whether to be pro-slavery or anti-slavery tell their stories. So you have to understand that even within Judaism, because you have the conservative Jews, you have the liberal Jews, you have the rabbinical Jews, the Hasidim, you've got various Jewish movements, subdivisions of Judaism, who disagree with each other about the true nature of the religion, but they are united against the non-Jewish world. So they do have their differences among each other, and they are not always in lockstep with the Rothschilds, but the Rothschilds do their absolute best to control the entirety of Jewry and get them all to march according to Rothschild rabbinical orders. So this is the way it works. They don't always succeed. There are renegade Jews, but this does not make these renegade Jews our friends either. So he continues, their words reveal the pride, pain, and ardor of these remarkable, yes, and there's a lot of pride and pain involved, because being Jewish, and you realize how subversive Judaism is, you know how subversive Judaism is, that's why these renegade Jews have so much guilt. So the pride, pain, and ardor of these remarkable people, yes, they're very remarkable, who were willing to put so much on the line. Well, ultimately, let's put it this way, the Jews that have white blood in them would tend to have a conscience and would therefore wonder about, you know, whether they're doing what they're doing is correct or not. And so, but your typical Hasidic Jew, your conservative Jew, these people, they're in lockstep with the Rothschilds and the rabbis, and there's no disagreements among these people. Some liberal Jews, basically, they take the position of being nice to the goyim so as to not stick out like a sore thumb, which is the basic pattern of the Murano Jews, the conversos, the Jews who pretended to convert to Christianity. So they pretend to be nice in public, but in reality, they are subversive Jews. Okay, that's all there is to it. They remain subversive Jews. He continues, whether in combat, in other forms of service to the war effort, on the home front, or in a host of other roles, their passion is unmistakable. Well, that's true. The Jews are always involved in politics, often taking both sides. But you cannot assume that if you have a so-called conservative Jew, that he's a real conservative. No, he's a kosher conservative. Or if that Jew is a liberal, he's a real liberal. No, he's a kosher liberal. That's why in the modern left, there is such conflict between the non-Jewish liberals who see that the Israeli state is an imperialistic machine dominating and persecuting the Palestinian people. This is a public relations nightmare for global Jewry, because there are many people on the left who see through this charade that the Jews are the persecuted people. Certainly not in Palestine, folks. Certainly not there. Okay. And of course, they have a PR issue with those of us on the right who tend to sympathize with what the Jews did to the German people at the Versailles Treaty, basically dispossessing Germany, the German people of Germany, and Jews moved in and took possession of it and tried to overthrow it with communism. Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht were in the forefront of that movement. So The Jews utterly destroyed Germany as a result of World War I and utterly destroyed Russia as a result of World War I. They maintained their stranglehold of Britain and France as a result of World War I. So World War I is a total victory for the Jews and a total loss for the Goyim. Absolutely a total loss for the Goyim. Same with World War II. Same with the Vietnam War, the Korean War, etc., etc. Some Jewish authors said the 20th century was the Jewish century. That's because the Jews won all those wars. He continues, yes, their passion is unmistakable, and their secrecy, their, even though they might be of different denominations of Jewry, they clam up when it comes to Jewish involvement in war. He continues, and of course, the war transformed them, their place in America, and in ways we are still struggling to understand America itself. Well, no, they're not. They know exactly the influence of the Jews in the Civil War and their effect on America and the creation of the mafia and, you know, the related criminal syndicates, the abortion industry, homosexuality. The Jews are behind all of that, with the large-scale immigration of Jews from Eastern Europe to America, beginning primarily in the 1890s. Once all these Jews started immigrating to America, you see the crime wave beginning in New York City, which was their primary location, spreading north, west, and south from there into the rest of America, the Las Vegas being another Jewish institution of gambling, prostitution, drugs, etc. Okay, so America was a very peaceful, I know you may think the Wild West wasn't, but comparative to today, we did not have any organized crime. This is a Jewish invention, and the Jews brought organized crime to America. Okay, so, and of course, the war transformed the Jews, their place in America, and in ways we are still struggling to understand. Well, let's put it this way. In ways in which they are struggling to keep silent, to keep away from the American people. Although few Jews, like other Americans, opposed slavery at the war's outset, let me just say, Northern whites considered it a Southern issue and did not want to get involved. Northern whites did not want to have blacks coming into their community and changing the racial demographic of, and they didn't farm anyhow. They didn't want to hire people that they would have to whip so that they would work. So they didn't want that either. The North was primarily opposed not to slavery, but to the effects that slavery was having in the North and the potential problem it would be for the North, such as blacks migrating into the North and lowering the wages across the board, which would affect the livelihoods of the whites. So there are a lot of issues involved in the North, but generally speaking, they did not oppose slavery vocally. And just like the Jews, they avoided talking about it when possible. It's just one of those sore spots that you don't talk about unless it becomes so egregious that you have to talk about it. Many came to feel that the suffering of the war needed to be about something important, the end of slavery and the creation of a different America. So, as the North in general gradually became opposed to slavery because of the media hype about it, similar Jews, like I said, the rabbinate does not control every single Jew. The rabbinate, and of course, was trying to keep a low profile on this issue, not talking about it. This means that the average Jew did not take instructions from rabbis as how to feel, how to look at slavery in America. So Northern Jews actually enlisted in the Northern Army. Southern Jews enlisted in the Southern Army, etc. He continues, the experience of Jews in New York City is indicative of this process in some ways. By far America's largest Jewish community, New York's Jews were overwhelmingly pro-Southern, pro-slavery, and anti-Lincoln in the early years of the war. You are listening to the Restoration Hour here on FreedomSlips.com, Revolution Radio, simulcasting on Eurofolk Radio, where you get the facts behind the scenes like no one else delivers such facts with thorough analysis, because I have made a lifelong study of the religion of Judaism and its posturing vis-a-vis the Christian white world and the lies, deception, intrigues that the Jews have engaged in throughout history against us, while they promote the idea that they're the ones who are persecuted. No, folks. It is their behind-the-scenes string-pulling and subterfuge which causes all of our problems. Causes all of our problems. And their use of non-whites against us via the Democratic Party, importing them against American law, and turning them into loyal Democrats who vote for the welfare state. This is how the Jews have meddled in American affairs ever since they arrived on our shores. Of course, it began with the institutions of distilling hard liquor in Newport, Rhode Island, and Charleston, South Carolina. Of course, the related institution of importing slaves, because the hard liquor they produced, they were sold in places around the world, including Africa, and often in exchange for black slaves who were then brought to South America and North America. So to get information like this, you have to listen to freedom of speech radio stations such as Revolution Radio. So make a point of going to the main website, www.freedomslips.com, and make a generous donation of Federal Reserve notes, which, of course, are controlled by Jews. But nevertheless, Nighthawk will accept Federal Reserve notes in spite of that fact. So thank you very much. Be kind and generous, because we need freedom of speech, which is a diamond in the rough. The assault on freedom of speech today is incredible. It's absolutely incredible. But fortunately, we have the internet and Revolution Radio, and of course, EurofolkRadio.com, where freedom of speech is the norm. Let's continue. This is an astounding admission. By far, America's largest Jewish community, New York's Jews, were overwhelmingly pro-Southern, pro-slavery, and anti-Lincoln in the early years of the war. Now, why would their attitude change? Well, toward the end of the war, they could see that the North was going to win. So they rewrote their history and pretended to be anti-slavery all along. That's how the Jews do it. He continues, increasingly, however, as both the toll of the war and the North's military victories mounted, feelings began to shift toward, quote, Father Abraham. Oh, yeah, now Abraham Lincoln is the leader of the Jewish community all of a sudden. Feelings began to shift toward Father Abraham. Can you believe this, folks? The Jews started calling Abraham Lincoln Father Abraham. They could see the way the political wind was blowing. His party, the Union, and see, all they cared about was themselves. That's all the Jews ever care about, is themselves. And now they had to start posturing as being pro-Union and eventually emancipation, which meant the Jews who owned slaves, which is virtually all of them, had to consider the proposition of giving them up and staying in the liquor business and other monopolies, which they are so good at, such as banking. So the Jewish community realized, okay, it's time to get out of the slavery business. We've made our millions. Collect your profits, close down the shops, close down the auction blocks, and move on. He says, close to 2,000 Jews from New York State joined the Union forces. I wonder if someone has the demographics on this and, you know, at what point in the war these Jews actually joined. In any case, as historian Howard Rock sums up, quote, the war was a transformative moment for the Jews. The Jews' understanding of American democracy. Well, it wasn't democracy. America is a republic with local rule, local representation. Democracy does not necessarily have local representation. Democracy is often a top-down institution with no local representation. But let's continue. The decision by the Jews' hospital, later Mount Sinai, to care for all sick and wounded soldiers and sailors was emblematic of the Jewish community's expanded civic commitment. Well, obviously, the Jewish community has to posture. And, of course, having sick and wounded soldiers in the Jewish hospital is a good PR move. You always have to understand that the Jews use public relations as a weapon. You cannot believe for one moment that these Jews really care about the soldiers and sailors who were put in harm's way by themselves, because the Jews are the ones who instigated the war. Okay? They always make themselves look good by these public relations moves. By war's end, a number of Jews became, and then they have historians emphasizing these moves. By war's end, a number of Jews became leaders in advancing the cause of civil liberties. Well, yeah, why? Because now they had another use for blacks, namely as a voting bloc against the white race. Quote, Father Abraham, unquote, became a hero to most Jews. Okay, it simply is a change in political strategy. That's all it is. The Jewish cult of Lincoln, and by the way, there was a Jewish brigade, probably from New York City, but included many other so-called American Jews, who were involved in the Spanish Revolution. They were Jewish communists, and they called themselves the Lincoln Brigade, by which anyone would assume, well, they really believed in the principles of Abraham Lincoln. No, they did not. They were communists. Lincoln was a champion of the working class and of upward mobility of hard workers. He was a champion of the working class, not communism. Those two, communism oppresses and enslaves the working class, does not liberate them. In other words, Abraham Lincoln was a champion of the American system, which is called free enterprise. He made something out of himself via that system, from a poor farmer's son to a comfortable country lawyer. He could not have done that under communism, or which is just another version of feudalism, in which you are born into a caste and you stay in that caste your entire life. Communism is like that, and feudalism is like that. The only economic system, the only political system which permits upward mobility is free enterprise, folks. Free enterprise, not the Jewish version of it, which is capitalism by Jewish bankers, where Jewish bankers spend money into circulation. No, Lincoln was a champion of the government issuing the currency. So Abraham Lincoln was in total opposition, whether he realized it or not, as he became president, of the Jewish economic system. He eventually learned that his main enemies in the banking establishment were Jews. And he probably understood that the cabal known as the Knights of the Golden Circle was controlled by B'nai B'rith because he had many of those people arrested. So it probably slowly dawned on Abraham Lincoln that the conspiracies against his life were actually committed by Jews, who, as we're finding out right here, were pro-slavery and would have opposed Abraham Lincoln certainly in the early days of the war. And this author is telling us that is the case. The Jewish cult of Lincoln, which had many Old Testament overtones, such as the claim that the Jews are Israel. And, you know, well, if the Jews were Israel, why weren't they opposed to slavery? Lincoln died on the first night of Passover, for instance. You think maybe there is a Jewish plot here? Abraham Lincoln was their sacrificial lamb, folks. This is not a coincidence. Lincoln died on the first night of Passover, for instance, and the first eulogies were delivered from synagogue pulpits. Yes, we must pretend that we supported Abraham Lincoln all along. And the Jewish cult of Lincoln would persist for decades. It persists today. Jewish literature, Jewish movies, such as the movie Lincoln, by the Jewish Hollywood movie producer, they still lionize Lincoln as the one who liberated the slaves. Well, that was a wartime move. Lincoln said, okay, you wouldn't free the slaves and send them back to Africa, so I'm going to confiscate your property. And that's what the slaves were. They were the property of the owners. And Lincoln said, well, you know, this is war, and I'm confiscating your property. Plain and simple. Mr. Yellis continues, the outcome of the nation's great existential crisis made possible the open and most welcoming society Jews had ever encountered. What one of my cousins, in a not uncommon Yiddish phrase, called Golden America. Well, yeah, the Industrial Revolution had come to America and enormous profits were to be made there. So the Jews en masse really had no choice but to get out of the slavery business, cash out, and invest their money in the Industrial Revolution. Very simple. Jews are business people after all. The Jews caught up in that crisis were transformed by it and in turn helped transform the America that emerged from it. Well, yeah, they did not get out of the banking business. They did not get out of the investment business. And they opened stores, retail stores. And guess what? The Jews were the biggest members of the carpetbagger industry, as General Grant found out. So, of course, this article is in very vague and general terms. He does not mention the carpetbaggers. That's another black spot in Jewish history that Jews don't like to talk about. Yet, relatively few Jews are aware of this, an amnesia that constitutes a deep loss. Well, again, the reason why there is this Jewish amnesia and this amnesia across the board regarding the American Civil War is that the Jews do not want you to know of their commitment to slavery and their creation of the American Civil War. You are not supposed to know what I'm telling you. Therefore, they have these art exhibits which say, well, we had, this was a problem for the Jewish community, but they got over it. Nothing about the subversive activities of Jews in creating the war, the subversive activities of Jewish carpetbackers and the profiteering of the Jewish community as the Civil War progressed. Nothing about that. Jews are always persecuted victims of the other races. You know, that dialogue, that phony dialogue, that fake news, that fake history must be maintained at all costs, lest you wake up. The history of the Civil War has long been bitterly contested. Yes, thank you very much. Perhaps as with the contest over slavery itself, it would be helpful if more Jews were engaged. Well, no, it wouldn't. This is really a cover piece, a cover-up piece, to suggest, well, yes, the Jews were pro-slavery, but they learned their lesson, as good Jews always learn their lesson, and they wound up being on the so-called right side of history. This is just another vague, general, you know, overview, or maybe I should call it an underview, of Jewish involvement in the American Civil War. Very little is published about this for obvious reasons. They want to keep this subject quiet. They don't want public discussion of Jewish involvement in slavery, nor do they want public discussion of the Holocaust. The Jewish community does everything in its power to silence critics of the Holocaust. Perhaps, as with the contest over slavery itself, it would be helpful if more Jews were engaged. No, there'd just be more fake history written about it. American Jews have a stake in this history, and their experience over the last 150 years makes a lot more sense if viewed through its lens. Well, yeah, it does. It does make a lot more sense. Let's talk about Jewish secret societies. Let's talk about Jewish bankers. Let's talk about the Rothschilds. Of course, Mr. Yellis would not be in favor of talking about those subjects. So here we hit. This is a typical Jewish piece of, you know, giving interesting snippets of information, like the business about Jewish slavery and how prevalent it was even in the North. These things are not talked about, and therefore there's interesting history to be shared, but none of it really reveals the total Jewish commitment to the Civil War on both sides. Ken Yellis, principal of the Project Development Services, served as a guest curator for the Passages Through the Fire, Jews and the Civil War. A historian with four decades in the museum field, Yellis has been involved in over 100 history, science, and art exhibitions. Well, you can be sure that Jews involved in the museum business are going to cover up the most interesting aspects of history. You can be sure about that. And certainly Jewish involvement in the negative aspects of history, such as the Civil War and Jewish involvement in it, a totally suppressed subject. But yours truly, Pastor Eli James, is exposing the reality of heavy Jewish involvement and virtually total control of both sides, the North and the South. That is the radical abolitionists of the North and the secessionists of the South, both of which were controlled by Jewish agents and Jewish money from the get-go, okay? You're not going to find this out from any other source except yours truly, Pastor Eli James, here at the Restoration Hour, RevolutionRadio.com, simulcasting on Eurofolk Radio. So I hope you found that. Whenever you read an article by a Jew, you must always read between the lines and understand it's nothing but propaganda. So they reveal some interesting snippets of Jewish involvement, but they cover up the total control of the conflict by Jewish forces. This they will always cover up. Now, in a related story here, because we understand that the secessionist, expansionist movement was always invading the country of Mexico. And so there was always tension between the slavocracy and Mexico. But you also have to understand there were a lot of Jews in Mexico. And I would say that the Jews of Mexico, again, this is not a popular theme. Aren't many history books written about this subject. The fact is that many Marranos from Spain and Portugal wound up moving to Mexico and setting up shop there. So they were pro-slavery. However, there weren't that many blacks in Mexico. And the American Indians, and you'd have to consider the indigenous natives of Mexico to be American Indians, they were not good for slavery. They would just run away. See, blacks were a confined people because, number one, if they escaped off the plantation, there's no way they could make a living. They'd have to stay out in the woods and become farmers or hunters. That was probably the only way they could survive. So, because if there was a free-roaming black in the South, you know, he would be captured and returned to their owner. This is not true of the American Indians, because the slavocracy of the South tried to enslave American Indians. But that didn't work because they would just escape. They knew how to live off the land, and they knew how to find their brethren in other American Indian tribes, Amerindian tribes. So the attempt by the Southern slavocracy to enslave American Indians did not work. Simply did not work. And interestingly enough, half-breed Indian tribal leaders would actually support the South in the institution of slavery. So you had American Indians in the Southwest supporting the South in the Civil War because it had a half-breed Southerner as the leader of the tribe. So the history of the Civil War is very much more convoluted than the, you know, white versus black, North versus South, slavery versus anti-slavery, states' rights versus the attempt to get rid of states' rights. All of these popular issues are fudged over and either simplified or ignored by mainstream historians, as I have been demonstrating in this series going on now 3 years and more, documenting the Jewish control and creation of the American Civil War. But you need to know a little bit about Jews in Mexico and their role in all of this. This is from aish.com, A-I-S-H.com, which is available, I see here, in Espanol, Francais, and Yiddish. And here it says, Wall Cam, Ask the Rabbi, Shabbat, Holocaust, Israel programs. So this is another Jewish website. And the title of the article is Surprising Facts About the Jews of Mexico. Yeah, I wonder who controls the drug cartels of Mexico. Are these Christians? Or are these Marranos? Again, this is a subject that the Jews do not like to talk about. But they do talk about it in their in-house publications, which are read almost exclusively by Jews. And even if a few Goyim happen to run across this website, they'll say, oh, okay, that's very interesting. Yeah, there were some Jews in Mexico. Well, I'm suggesting to you that the Jews of Mexico run the drug cartels. And what do you have down there? You're the corporate control of Mexico today. The drug cartels still rule Mexico. Nothing has changed. The Catholic Church has a heavy presence. the Catholic Church's role in all of this, you know, because what we're talking about is Jewish organized crime. The Catholic Church serves to appease the peasants. It serves to appease the peasants. That's all it does. So, folks, we're talking about, again, the hidden history of Judaism in the American Civil War, and their role in Mexico. Surprising facts about the Jews of Mexico. Mexico boasts a thriving Jewish community with roots that go back 500 years, by Dr. Yvette Altmiller. Some of the most vibrant Jewish neighborhoods in North America exist south of the border. In Mexico, I'll bet they're very vibrant. All right, folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back with more about this subject coming up.
Reality Extraction, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Row on Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, 6 to 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are your hosts, Pamela
and Claire, on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Featuring the public law trust, Lyme disease,
and astrology. Witnessing those who harm and holding them accountable.
Guess what? No more secrets. It's about time we snap out of it. This corporate government is a house of cards falling in on itself. The public law. Do no harm.
When I knock eco-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of
more... Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
Just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that. Oh, what? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back. This is your muckraker, Pastor Eli James, and this is, of course, the Restoration Hour, simulcasting on Revolution Radio and Eurofolk Radio, and you're always going to get the skinny, the poop, the dirt. That's what muckrakers do, finding out what's really going on as opposed to what the kosher press tells you. Of course, the kosher press is nothing but lies, propaganda, and PR. We're just getting into this article entitled The Surprising Facts About the Jews of Mexico. Mexico boasts a thriving Jewish community with roots that go back 500 years. Again, the author of this article is Dr. Yvette Altmiller. Some of the most vibrant Jewish neighborhoods in North America exist south of the border in Mexico, where over 40,000 Jews have created a close-knit, distinct community. Well, as you should know, any student of Judaism knows that the Jews never assimilate. They always create a state within a state, as Benjamin Franklin pointed out, and they use their state within a state as a hive from which to exploit, distort, and subvert and destroy the indigenous people, the indigenous country. So now we're being told by Dr. Yvette Altmiller that there's at least 40,000 Jews who have created a close-knit, distinct community. Okay, now, is this close-knit, distinct community of Jews good for Mexico or bad for Mexico? Are they doing things that benefit the Amerindians, like the Mayans and the Aztecs? Or are they exploiting the Mayans and the Aztecs and blaming Whitey for the exploitation? Here are some surprising facts about North America's least known Jewish centers. Again, nobody ever talks about this. So you're not supposed to even suspect that the Jews run the crime syndicates of Mexico, or that the Jews control the Mexican economy. You're not supposed to know that. Early Jewish haven. When Hernan Cortez first conquered Mexico for Spain in 1521, he did so with a number of secret Jews amongst his men. Now, this is not some white nationalist Christian identity conspiracy theorist speaking. This is direct from the Jewish website, AISH. And the author is, again, Dr. Yvette Altmiller. Thank you, Leroy. There's a problem with the broadcaster at Eurofolk Radio, so you'll have to switch over. You have to switch over to EFR. Okay, yes. Let me give him a quick note. Okay, thank you. All right, so don't know why my broadcaster isn't working. It was working fine last night. Kind of a typical experience we've been having with our software. It's a software problem. But in any case, let's get back to this item here. And this is, again, a Jewish website. Dr. Yvette Altmiller is the author. And she is talking about this, well, this, how should I put it, this hidden Jewish community within Mexico. When Hernan Cortes first conquered Mexico for Spain in 1521, he did so with a number of secret Jews amongst his men. Judaism was banned at the time in Spain, and soon many secret Spanish Jews departed for Nueva España, that is New Spain, in the New World to try and live a more Jewish life. That is, they wanted to be involved in organized crime, secret societies, and all the other secret stuff that Jews do, secret and subversive stuff that Jews do, because the Spanish people had gotten wise to their subversion of their country, Spain, and had forced Queen Isabella to get rid of them. This is what happens in all white nations where Jews settle. The native people eventually get wise to the Jews' subversion of their society and culture, as they are doing to America, Australia, Canada, Europe, etc. The Jews have always been subversives and destroyers wherever they have gone. And in the name of persecution, oh, we were persecuted in that country, so please let us live in your country. And they proceed to subvert and destroy the new country. That's why they have been expelled from well over 100 Christian nations throughout history. So, they wanted to live a more Jewish life, which they couldn't do anymore in Spain and Portugal. In fact, Spain's first viceroy in Mexico, Antonio de Mendoza, possessed a Jewish surname, and historians suggest he was possibly one of the secret Jews who moved to the new territory. So it didn't take long for these conversos slash Marranos to establish themselves in the new world. King Philip II of Spain soon established the Kingdom of Nuevo León in Mexico and parts of what is today Texas. And Texas, folks. So, again, my question is, what was the role of Mexican Jews in slavery? This article probably doesn't get into this, but as we found out in the previous hour of the show, American Jews were almost 100% pro-slavery, both North and South. And this is from the admission of another Jewish website. So, something you didn't know, did you? Well, what's the role of the Mexican Jews in slavery? This article probably doesn't get into that, but it does tell us that there was a hidden, which means secret and subversive, Jewish community in Mexico very early on. Yes. Folks, this is the case. Can't get away from this fact that the Jews are always insinuating themselves into white Christian society in order to subvert and destroy while pretending to be our saviors. All right, so we have this new, the first viceroy in Mexico was probably a Jew, according to this Jewish website, AISH.com. And he appointed Don Luis de Carvajal, a well-known Portuguese Jew, Spanish nobleman who was born to Jewish conversos, or forced converts as governor of the new territory. So you have this Jew as the viceroy, and you have a Jewish governor right from the get-go. Mexico was controlled by Jews already. Carvajal welcomed both Jews and Catholics. By Jews and Catholics. Guess what, folks? The Jews were in control of this already. All right, right from the get-go, the Jews don't waste any time in establishing themselves. What, in a way, well, there was gold. They found gold in the New World. Gold is like a magnet for Jews. Now, again, I alluded to the Catholic role in all of this. The role of the Catholic Church in the New World, and in much of the Old World as well, was to appease the peasants. So while the Jews take control of the new territory by economic means, the Catholic Church controls the minds of the peasants so that they swallow their oppression with the gospel. A little bit of gospel, a little bit of oppression always goes down, because the little bit of the gospel is the sugar that they sprinkle on the oppression. And the Mexican peasants are none the wiser as to the fact that their country has been taken over by the Jewish mafia. So, Don Luis de Carvajal, a well-known Portuguese-Spanish nobleman who was born to Jewish conversos, which makes him a Jew, was the governor of the new territory. Carvajal welcomed both Jews and Catholics into his land. His nephew, Luis Rodriguez Carvajal, embraced his Jewish identity. Embraced his Jewish identity. Because he was in the New World, after all, and there was plenty of gold to be had in the New Kingdom, and encouraged other secret Jews to do the same. I'll bet you had no idea of the powerful Jewish presence in Nuevo España. Inquisition in Mexico. The Spanish Inquisition, which forbade any Jewish practice, spread to Mexico in 1571. Many of the new territory's Jews fled to neighboring Peru. Jews who chose to remain faced torture and execution if it was discovered that they continued to practice their faith. Now you can see that the Jews have this long, tortuous history of having to decide whether to be secret Jews, that is, conversos, moranos, hiding their faith, or actually converting to Christianity. Let me tell you right from the get-go here, folks, that if one half of 1% or 0.1% of Jews actually became Christians and left their Jewish faith behind, I would be surprised at that number, because the Jews, being Edomites, Canaanites, and Khazars, have nothing in common with the white race whose religion is true Christianity, segregationist or separatist Christianity, as we like to call it, Christian separatism. That this penchant the Jews have for subversion and deceit and intrigue is inbred. It's part of their DNA. So this is nothing new. This has been going on since the Pharisees took over from the Levitical priesthood in Palestine, because the Levitical priesthood was no longer necessary with the sacrifice of Christ at Calvary. So that was no longer necessary. But the Pharisees took over the Levitical priesthood and became known as Pharisees. So Judaism is not the continuation of the Levitical priesthood. Pharisaic Judaism is the, what's the proper word? They really didn't overthrow it. because it was no longer necessary. But what they did was they pretended thenceforth to be the Israelite priesthood. Okay, so this would be the confiscation or the pretension of the Edomite Jews as being the Levitical priesthood. And that's how they established themselves in Palestine. This occurred during the first 100 years before Christ, as, King John Hyrcanus, who was a true-blooded Judahite, made the gigantic mistake of circumcising Edomites circa 121 BC and incorporating them as citizens of Judah, thus changing Judah into Judea, combination of Judah and Idumea, Idumea being the Greek word for Edom. So John Hyrcanus violated Yahweh's laws by integrating these two populations of Israelites and Edomites. This gave the Jews the idea of impersonating Israel. Of course, they had this idea before, but this was the first implementation by these Edomites of impersonating Israel, and they were known as the Pharisees. That is the true beginning of the Jewish impersonation of Israel, the first 100 years before Christ in Palestine. So this tendency of the Jews to be deceitful pretenders, it actually began before Judea, but it was finalized in Judea. Their pretense as Israel was created in Judea already before the days of Christ, and Christ, Yahshua Messiah, thoroughly rejected the Pharisees and called them children of the devil. He knew what they were, but modern Christians and most moderns today have no idea that the Jews are not Israelites at all. Getting back to this article, some of the earliest victims of the Mexican Inquisition were family members of the governor Luis de Carvajal. His sister Francisca was arrested on charges of being a Jew, tortured, and burned at the stake, along with four of her children, Isabel, Catalina, Leonor, and Luis, in 1596. So the Inquisition caught up with them. This doesn't mean that the conversos or Muranos disappeared. No, it just drove them back underground, which is familiar territory for subversives. His sister, in 1601, another daughter, Mariana, was burned. She even took the name of Mary. Can you believe it? In 1601, another daughter, Mariana, was burned at the stake for the crime of being Jewish as well. No. It's not the crime of being Jewish. It's the crime of subversion. It's the crime of subversion, folks. See, the Jewish definition of anti-Semitism, the official ADL definition, is hating Jews just because they're Jewish. It means hating Jews for no reason. Well, that's never the case. The Jews weren't expelled from all those Christian countries for no reason at all. They were expelled for subversion and for falsely converting to Christianity while, in fact, still practicing Judaism. They were expelled for their lies, deceit, and oppression of the Christian peasantry. That's the real reason. So this idea that the Jews are persecuted for no reason is pure fiction, folks. It's absolute pure fiction. And this article is purveying that fiction. But let's continue. Governor de Carvajal himself was arrested on charges of practicing Judaism and died in prison in 1595. Well, at the very least, he was being deceitful in the first place for having pretended to be a Christian at all. Okay. That's what the Inquisition was all about. Digging up these fake Christians who were in fact subversives and who were destroying Spain, Portugal, and now they were practicing the same tactics in Nuevo España. Jews were soon pursued throughout Mexico. Suspicious activities that could brand someone a Jew included bathing on a Friday and afterwards putting on clean clothes, supposedly clean clothes, draining and disposing of blood after slaughtering a bird to eat, fasting on Yom Kippur, well, yeah, that would raise suspicion, eating tortillas, which are unleavened, during Passover, and circumcising sons. Well, that was not common for American Indians, right? Anyone guilty of these crimes faced drastic punishments, including torture, imprisonment, forced wearing of a sanbenito, a knee-length yellow gown, and you thought the Germans forced the Jews to wear yellow armbands. No, this is an old tradition, folks. Or a dunce cap. And ultimately execution if you persisted in your Jewish ways. In a parenthetical statement here, the author includes, visitors to the Zocalo, the main plaza in the center of Mexico City today, might be unaware that this was the main location where generations of Jews were publicly burned at the stake for the crime of being Jewish. No, not for the crime of being Jewish, for the crime of subversion. By the time the Inquisition was abolished in Mexico in 1821, approximately 100 Jews had been killed and many more imprisoned. So all of this suggests that the Jews ultimately came to power in Mexico because they were able to undo the Inquisition there. Cinco de Mayo, the struggle for Mexican independence and Mexico's Jews. Happy Cinco de Mayo, everybody! You didn't know there was a Jewish connection to Cinco de Mayo, did you? Cinco de Mayo celebrates the Battle of Puebla when a small Mexican force led by General Ignacio Zaragoza Seguin defeated a much larger French army on May 5, 1862. The area of Puebla might have been a home to a thriving secret Jewish community of its own. See the section on Jewish Mexican food below. Oh, no. Don't tell me tortillas are a Jewish invention. Well, all they had was corn. So, folks, this is crazy. Okay, so we have, on the one hand, the author tells us that Jews are publicly burned simply for the crime of being Jewish. Yet she constantly asserts that the Jews had these secret communities which were subversive of Christianity. You cannot have it both ways. You cannot insist that Christians have a right to be free of subversive secret Jewish communities. And then say, well, the Jews were persecuted for no reason. She is talking out of both sides of her mouth, as most Jews do. So, Cinco de Mayo, May 5th, 1862. Happy Cinco de Mayo, everybody. You should all have a Mexican tortilla, guacamole, for breakfast. Despite this victory, French forces went on to conquer Mexico. So not much liberation happened that day. It was just a little a skirmish. Probably the only skirmish that the Mexicans won. That's why they celebrated. And set up the short-lived Second Mexican Empire. In 1864, Emperor Maximilian I declared himself ruler, and though he never consolidated his reign over all of Mexico, the short-lived monarch did make one remarkable change in Mexico. He issued an edict of religious tolerance and invited German Jews to settle in Mexico. Oh, okay. Now we have Spanish Jews, Portuguese Jews, and now German Jews settling in Mexico. Why? To exploit the peasants. That's why. When Maximilian was deposed and executed in 1867, his successor, Mexican nationalist President Benito Juarez, continued to enforce a separation of church and state, ensuring that Mexico remained a haven for Jewish immigrants. Do you think some Jewish bribe money influenced Benito Juarez? Who financed his army? This Mexican peasant. Who financed it? Where did he get the money for all the ammo and the food to pay his army? Where did he get that from? You know that war is the Jews' harvest. Jewish refugees began to pour into Mexico. Ashkenazi Jews fleeing pogroms in Russia and Eastern Europe came in the 1880s, establishing Mexico's first synagogue in Mexico City in 1885. And the parasites have never left the country of Mexico. So the question begs to be asked, to what extent do the Jews still rule in Mexico? And I would say to a very great extent, just as the extent of America, Europe, Australia, etc., where Jews control all the banking industries and therefore inveigle themselves into the rest of the economy and into the politics and into the culture, subverting it yet again. So if you talk about Mexican drug cartels, you are talking about Jews, ladies and gentlemen. Sephardic Jews soon followed. Now, the Portuguese and Spanish Jews were already Sephardic. So this is, I don't know what the purpose of this, they were all, Sephardic Jews were already there. Maybe they're talking about, well, maybe Dutch Jews. Anyway, the banking Jews, the banking class of Jews were soon to follow. Sephardic Jews soon followed, fleeing persecution in the crumbling Ottoman Empire. Sephardic Jews had an added incentive to immigrate to the new nation. They spoke Ladino, a Spanish-derived, I told you, Sephardic Jews and Spanish Jews are the same, a Spanish-derived Jewish dialect that helped them feel at home in Spanish-speaking Mexico. Yes, the word Ladino, spelled with a D, is the source word for Latino. Latino. What is a Latino? It's a Sephardic Jew pretending to be Mexican, Peruvian, etc. See, this penchant that the Jews have for being chameleons in the host country, that is, parasites in the host country, is shared by Jews everywhere. So, but they also do their absolute best to minimize public attention upon themselves. They do not want to draw attention to themselves. They prefer to work behind the scenes so as not to arouse the curiosity and ire of the local population, such as happened in Spain and Portugal. Such as happened in Spain and Portugal. Folks, this story of Jewish subversion of white Christian society and other societies as well. We just talked about the Ottomans. It's an ongoing story. It's an ongoing story. So, all right, I'm being told to disconnect, even though the broadcaster is telling me that I'm streaming. And so there's a problem with the broadcaster. I'm just going to disconnect from it since it's not broadcasting on EFR. Anyway, so let's continue with this. Again, if you understand true Jewish history, you can read between the lines and you can expose the contradictions in their teaching. The word Latino comes from the word Ladino, which means a Spanish-speaking Jew. So these Spanish-speaking Jews influenced Mexico to the effect that Latino is the language there. Spanish, Jewish, Spanish, Spanish, Jewish people who have taken control of Mexico. Now, Lithuania, Damascus, and Aleppo in Mexico City. I bet you had no idea there were so many Jews in Mexico. Mexico's oldest standing synagogue is the Sephardi Synagogue, built in 1923 in the heart of Mexico City at 83 Justo Sierra Street. Now, this contradicts the statement she made up above, where she said Mexico's first synagogue, Mexico City's first synagogue, was an Ashkenazi synagogue built in 1885. Okay? Again, these kind of contradictions are common in Jewish radio. And now I'm being told that we're broadcasting on EFR, even though I just disconnected the broadcaster. I am perplexed. So I am perplexed. Anyway, let's continue here. Down, okay, the Sephardi synagogue, she probably meant to say Mexico's oldest standing synagogue. Maybe something happened to the Ashkenazi synagogue. Built in 1923 in the heart of Mexico City at 83 Justo Sierra Street. Although the Jewish community has long since moved to the suburbs. Yeah, away from the riffraff. Away from the Catholic riffraff. Jews who work downtown still frequent the congregation during the working week. Down the street is Mexico's first Ashkenazi synagogue, Justo Sierra, built in 1941. Again, she just said there was one Ashkenazi synagogue built in 1885. So this is very confusing. Anyway, this one in Justo Sierra, built in 1941, as a replica of a magnificent Lithuanian synagogue. Folks, I'll bet you had no idea that Mexico was also controlled by Jews. Builders worked from a photograph, copying the ornate details faithfully. Fear of crime and terrorism haunt Mexico's Jews. I wonder why. Is it because the Mexican drug cartels are run by Jews? And it comes back to bite you in the ass? Making them highly security conscious and wary of maintaining the safety and security of their synagogues and other communal buildings. Well, if the Jews weren't involved in organized crime, maybe they wouldn't have such a problem. Today's Mexican Jewish community is tightly knit and contains several distinct strands. Two separate Syrian communities thrive, each with their own traditions from Aleppo and Damascus. Ashkenazi Jews maintain the traditions they brought with them from Eastern Europe. Another group of Mexican Sephardi Jews hails from the Balkans and keeps those memories alive through family recipes and customs. So I wonder how many of these Mexican dishes we eat are actually Jewish in origin. Finally, a fifth group has made its mark on Mexico's Jewish community in recent years. Immigrants from the United States who call Mexico home now, and of course their pensions and their Social Security checks buy a lot more stuff in Mexico than in New York City, who call Mexico home now and have brought their own distinct traditions, that is their own version of organized crime, from north of the border to Mexico. Jumex, a Jewish Mexican cuisine. Please don't tell me hush puppies are Jewish. Please don't tell me that. All right. You are listening to, to the Restoration Hour here at www.freedomslips.com. Now actually simulcasting on Eurofolk Radio for the duration of the show. And we're having fun with the Jewish issue and exposing the relevance of Judaism in the New World, which most people don't talk about. Actually, it's a forbidden subject. It's as forbidden as discussing the Holocaust. But we have no such fear here on the Restoration Hour. So please, if you want freedom of speech to continue to thrive in America, go to the main website, www.freedomslips.com, and make a generous donation of shekels, tortillas. There are places where tortillas pass as money. And help this freedom of speech venue stay alive and thrive. Back to the article. Jumex. Leroy tells me Vincente Fox is a Jew. I am not surprised. Thank you very much. A few of Mexico's best-known dishes turn out to have been surprisingly Jewish origins. Buñuelos, the quintessential Mexican winter holiday dish of golden deep-fried balls of cheese-infused dough. Oh, no. Hush puppies are Jewish. I can't believe it. Originated as a Sephardi Hanukkah dish. The oil used to fry these savory snacks was originally meant to invoke the miracle of the oil. I'll bet it's pork, labeled as olive oil. Some theorize, pork fat. I forget. Lard. Yeah, I bet it's lard, not olive oil. Some theorize that the springtime Mexican dish, capirotada, a rich bread pudding infused with sweet cheese and drenched in syrup, also originated with Mexican Jews as a way of disguising their consumption of unleavened bread during Passover. Just add syrup or barbecue sauce. Pan de Semita, the iconic sesame seed-studded roll of Mexico's Puebla region, the area where the Battle of Puebla is celebrated in Cinco de Mayo celebrations. So, all of you folks listening, have some Jumex food today, will you? Pan de Semita has been linked to secret Jews who possibly ate it as an unleavened alternative to regular bread during Passover. Another iconic Mexican regional dish. You had no idea the Jews have had so much influence on Mexico, did you? Roast suckling goat, enjoyed in and around the Mexican city of Monterrey, which also contains an established Jewish presence, was likely Jewish in origin as a way for secret Jews to avoid eating the roast suckling pig, so popular in much of Mexico. The Jews eat pork too. Don't be fooled. Culinary influences have gone both ways. Mexican Jewish cooks have adapted the bright flavors and fresh fruits of Mexico to traditional Jewish dishes, adding chilies and gefilte fish, oh no, and tropical spices to chicken soup. What? Gefilte fish and chicken soup? I've never heard of such a thing. In Mexico City today, kosher consumers can enjoy Mexican staples embraced by the Jewish community, such as quesadillas, corn tortillas that are filled, folded, and fried, flautas, tortillas that are rolled and fried, sopes, fried circles of cornmeal dough, chalupas, cups of fried cornmeal. That doesn't sound inviting at all. all filled with Mexican delicacies such as queso, that's cheese, nopales, cactuse, frijoles, refried beans, salsa, and guacamole. So, the last few are actually Mexican. Queso, nopales, frijoles, salsa, and guacamole. These are actually Mexican. All the other stuff is Jewish. Even street food has been available at kosher stands in Mexico City, which might as well be called Jew York City South, Southwest, ensuring that Mexico's Jews don't miss out on their country's delicious snacks. Yeah, good stuff. Jewish organizations reach every corner of the community's life. Okay, here again, the title of the heading here is Tight-Knit Community, Bright Future. Again, what did I tell you at the beginning of the show? The Jews do not assimilate. While the Jews encourage blacks, Mexicans, Asians, etc., to assimilate, that is, racially intermarry with white people, well, the Jews are already a race-mixed people. But they insist on not mixing with the indigenous people, because otherwise their culture would be destroyed. So the Jews, while they insist that white people assimilate with other races and white people assimilate with Jewish culture does not assimilate. It maintains its identity as a parasitic presence, as a state within a state, in every country where they exist, as this article proves about Mexico, and which the experience of Spain and Portugal proved there. And we have German Jews destroying Germany after World War I, Russian Jews destroying Russia after World War I. The Jews do not assimilate. That is Jewish law, folks. Whatever pretensions they may have publicly, Jews do not assimilate. They always maintain their state within a state. Hence, the last heading here, tight-knit community. By tight-knit, read non-assimilable community. Bright future. Well, yeah, everything looks bright for the Jews. They totally control the economy and the cuisine of Mexico as well. Jewish organizations reach every corner of the community's life. Yes. Most of these organizations are very segregationist, Jewish segregationist, and do not encourage mixing of Jews with the indigenous people, although they engage in this anyway, because that's how they gain control of the community around them, by marrying into them. Nevertheless, you have to have a core group of rabbis who maintain their Edomite DNA as the leading organizations. And, of course, the Rothschilds. Well, the Rothschilds are Ashkenazi Jews with a smattering of Edomite DNA as well, because the Ashkenazis intermarried with the Hittites way back in the first millennium AD. So your Edomite blood comes from the Hittites, and the Mongol blood comes from the Ashkenazim. So you see that the Ashkenazim are very, vibrant, which is the word this author likes to use. Virulent is the word. Virulent strain of Jewish blood. Even worse than Edomite blood because of the Mongolian addition. Okay, so interestingly here, we find that these Jewish organizations, now the other purpose of these Jewish quote-unquote welfare organizations is, well, it's twofold. Number one, they need to make sure that the Jewish community stays intact and separate from, in whatever ways possible, the indigenous people, whether white people in America, Mexicans in Mexico, Frenchmen in France, Brits in Britain, etc. The Jewish community always has to heighten the sense of the Jews' difference from the indigenous people, okay, and always pretending that they're Israelites. So the Jewish organizations, not just the rabbis, but these Jewish organizations are there to maintain this distinction and this pretense that the Jews are Israelites. That's the number one function of these Jewish organizations. Number two, they actually do serve the interests of poor Jews and middle-class Jews, which maintains their loyalty to the subversive Jews known as the Rothschilds, the bankers, the secret societies, B'nai B'rith, and etc. All these Jewish organizations have a twofold purpose. Number one, to maintain the loyalty of the Jewish community around them. And number two, to heighten the distinction between Jews and non-Jews. That's why the Jewish community is so tight-knit, as this title, this section heading, indicates. Jewish organizations reach every corner of the community's life, providing independent ambulance services, welfare organizations, social groups, bar mitzvahs and bath mitzvahs, and a generous supply of porn industry actors, even a dedicated and anti-kidnapping response group. Well, since the Jews control the kidnapping industry worldwide, and the Jewish mafia is highly involved in this, well, occasionally a Jewish kid, maybe a kid that doesn't look very Jewish, but is Jewish, gets kidnapped. And so the Jewish organization says to the kidnappers, hey, wait a minute, you got a Jewish kid there. Let it go. We need more parasites. Intermarriage rates are among the lowest in the world. 94% of Mexican Jews marry other Jews. Approximately 95% of Mexican Jews are affiliated with the Jewish community. Tight-knit? Did somebody say Jews stick together? And about 95% of children attend one of the community's 16 different Jewish schools. So you can see, despite the fact that Jews are one of the most race-mixed genomes in the world, they are by no means a pure race. Yet they stick together, 94%, 95%, and 95% are the figures given here by this Jewish author. This is how closely they stick together. Now, Jews will intermarry. If male Jews will marry white women simply because these white women are prettier and have, let's say, more pleasing personalities than Jewish women. So there's no way the rabbis can stop this from happening. Jewish men rebel against marrying Jewish women. But where the rabbis can control this, they do. Rates of anti-Semitism remain low. Why? Because the Jews control Mexico. In June 2003, then-President Vicente Fox passed a law that forbids discrimination, including anti-Semitism. And as Leroy told me, Vicente Fox is himself Jewish. Adding a greater level of security for Mexico's 40,000-plus Jews. It's got to be more than that. It's got to be more than that. Jewish community leader, they always underestimate their own presence. Jewish community leader Rene Dayan Shabbat was in the Mexican Senate the day the law was passed. Quote, it came time for any arguments against the law, unquote, she recalls, and there was complete silence. Then, as now, Mexico embraced its small but vibrant Jewish population. Again, strike vibrant and insert virulent. So we can see from reading these Jewish articles online that they are very revealing about Jewish culture, while at the same time maintaining the pretense that they are not subversive of the indigenous culture. It's very interesting, and as I suspected, this article would not get into the subject of the Mexican Jewish attitude towards slavery. However, we find that in the northeastern provinces of Mexico, there was a strong pro-slavery sentiment. I have in the past averred to Freemasonry, because the Freemasons were heavily involved, as well as the Catholic Church, heavily involved in the building of Mexican cities and temples and monuments. You will see there was a heavy Freemasonic presence in Mexico. Of course, the Catholic presence in Mexico is undeniable. All these temples, whether Freemasonic or Catholic, and of course a smattering of Jewish synagogues were built in or around Mexico City, and in, I think, Montevideo and elsewhere in Central America. So you cannot get away from Jewish and Catholic presence, and what I am telling you today is that the Catholic Church acts as a buffer, as an appeasement agency for Jewish subversion. So you keep the peasants oppressed with Catholic mumbo jumbo and worship of Catholic saints, and telling the Mexican people, this is your lot. You cannot make any dent in the Catholic and Jewish presence in Mexico, as long as these two powers thrive in the country of Mexico. And the Catholic faith winks at or looks the other way when Jewish crime is involved and the Jewish mafia operate. And they do the same thing in America. Jewish mafia bosses pretend to be Christians, and the Catholic Church stages funerals for Jewish mafia bosses, and it makes Christianity look bad, while in fact these mafia bosses are Jews, not Christians. So it's all a game. It's a publicity stunt that the Catholic Church and the Jewish mafia engage in. So don't be fooled. These two corporations, and that's what they are. The Catholic Church is a 501c3 corporation, and being based in a foreign country, namely the Vatican, they have diplomatic immunity. Therefore, Catholic priests who molest children are rarely prosecuted. It takes a major local community effort to prosecute a Catholic priest who has been molesting Catholic children. And you don't see any Jews prosecuting these Catholic priests, do you? That's because the Jews are the international leaders of the child kidnapping industry. And, of course, the porn industry. So all those feminists out there who talk about rape culture, don't blame the white patriarchy. Don't blame the white patriarchy. Blame the Catholic Church, which is multicultural, not white, and Judaism, which promotes multiculturalism and rape culture. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh. Take care. Thank you.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Take a look around, kid. What do you see? Homes being foreclosed. People working 2-3 jobs just to put food on the table and still drowning in debt. Don't get me wrong. This country was founded on great ideals and principles. They've all been ruined by the banks. Open your eyes to banks that are robbing you. You know who my favorite president was?
Who?
Thomas Jefferson. Because he saw all of this coming and tried to stop it. He fought the banks. JFK too, and they killed him for it. The banking institution is more dangerous than an army, he said. He also said that every generation needs a revolution, Jimmy. The American dream is just that. Just a dream. War is a continuation of politics, only by other means. Politics is a continuation of economics by other means. This is our bank. This is our war. And this is our plan of attack.
Banks have become an essential threat to our democracy. So consider this justice.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution. Radio!
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Join me weekdays for my new show, Tell Chris Joe. It's going to be a problem show brought to you live from Kensington. Thursdays, I'm dealing with hot topics, heated debate, what's new around the world, and ring-ins to discuss listeners' problems and offering considered and heartfelt solutions. So join me, Chris Hart, for Tell Chris Joe. Stop what you're doing, grab a cup of tea, I'm coming live from Kensington. Relax. Let me entertain you with a coffee bar online. Listeners, very personal problems. So that's Thursdays, 2 p.m. in the afternoon, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. See you there. It's going to be lots of fun.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener.